Welcome to Earth Plus Humans, where we explore problems in need of solution. I'm your host, Trislyn Nelson, professor and the Jack and Laura Dangerman Chair of Geography at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Today, we're talking about the geography of sex. I run a couple of websites for crowdsourcing data, and though the data are anonymous, we ask details like race, age, and gender. A lot of people hate it. They tell us it's none of our business. And I get it. Who we are feels private. But if you're trying to find patterns in data, especially health data, personal details can help us accurately predict injury, health, and well-being. Geographers have long leveraged another key predictor of health: place. Where you're born, live, and work are often predictors of your health because places vary in terms of access to healthy food, clean air, and quality of health care. In fact, your postal code or zip code has a life expectancy, and even in a country like the United States, life expectancy can vary by decades depending on where you live. With the onset of COVID-19, we have seen an explosion in the use of maps to quantify the geography of outbreaks and track spread. Viruses are spatial. They have geography. Malaria is geographically constrained to tropics and subtropical areas where temperature, humidity, and rainfall are high. Typhoid is most prevalent in South Asia due to water pollution and high levels of rain. Sexually transmitted diseases also have a geography. So the geography of sex is, you guessed it, about how diseases transmitted through sex vary depending on where you are, who you are, and how you live. I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Susie Castles to Earth Plus Humans. Dr. Castles is an associate professor and health geographer in the Department of Geography at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Dr. Castles has expertise in epidemiology and global health, and her research focuses on geographic mobility, sexual health, and HIV prevention. She also teaches a popular first-year course called Sex, Drugs, and Geography. Hey, Susie, thanks for joining me.
Sure, thanks for having me.
So, you're a health geographer. Can you start off by just giving us the big picture of what does a health geographer do?
Sure. I get asked that a lot by family members who are unsure what geography is, let alone health geography. So I like to think of health geography as considering all of the things that affect health that are above and beyond our individual characteristics and behaviors. So things that affect our health, like where we live, the natural environment, the built environment, the networks of people we interact with, that kind of stuff.
So there are, you know, some health issues that are easy to think about, sort of the relationship between geography and health. So like air quality issues, you know, it might be easy to think about if you live in a poorer quality area, you may have more lung issues, for example. But one of the things that you study a lot is the geography of sex. So what does sex have to do with geography?
That's a good question. So I study the geography of sex, but I often think of it as with the outcome of sexual health. So it's maybe a little easier to think of the geography of, say, a sexually transmitted infection or HIV, or the geography of access to sexual health prevention or interventions. So when I think of the geography of sex, I actually think about sexual networks. So both kind of the sexual connections people have over space and time, but what the geography of those networks look like as well. Because then that gives you a sense of the potential pathways in which a sexually transmitted infection can spread.
So when you think about, can you talk a little bit more about what a network is in this mm-hmm. case?
Sure. So, you know, we are all part of networks. We have friendship networks where the people are connected through a relationship, like a friendship. Or email networks, you know, whenever you send an email to someone, the connection is the email that's sent. A sexual network is the same idea, but the connection is a sexual contact.
So there's obviously a number of diseases that can be spread through sexual contact, but one that you've really focused on is HIV. So can you tell me, like, what is the status of HIV in the U.S. these days?
Oh, sure. Good question. I feel like we don't talk about HIV as much as we used to in the 90s and early 2000s. So HIV is still a global phenomenon. Of course, there are ways that we can prevent and treat HIV, but there's still no cure or no vaccine either. And globally, there are disparities. So some countries have way higher levels of HIV than others. Within the U.S., there's also significant disparities. So more than 3 out of 4 people living in the U.S. who have HIV are sexual minority men, so gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men. And there's also significant disparities by race and ethnicity. So Black and Hispanic men also have much higher rates of HIV. On average, I think the prevalence of HIV in the U.S. is less than 0.5%. So it's fairly low when you think about comparing it to, say, COVID or something.
Right.
But HIV is also a disease that you live with for the rest of your life. It's not curable.
And so what sort of behaviors can change the likelihood mm-hmm. of transmission of HIV? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously mm-hmm. having sex is mm-hmm. one way, but then within that, what are
sure,
the
yeah. So there are a lot of ways to prevent acquiring HIV. Of course, using a condom is one of the best ways. If of course, you could forego sex, but that's not something that anyone necessarily should or would want to do. But there are ways to have intercourse, a healthy intercourse. So yes, using a condom, of course. But also, there are a lot of couples where one person is infected with HIV and the other isn't, or even heterosexual couples where they want to have a child. There are ways to engage in sex in ways where you could get pregnant, but then try to avoid getting HIV. So if someone is living with HIV, they can use antiretroviral therapy, which can lower the level of virus in somebody's body to close to zero, which makes it almost virtually impossible to transmit it to the other person. On the other hand, somebody who is not living with HIV but has a sexual partner who does have HIV, they can use what we call pre-exposure prophylaxis. So that's a similar type of drug that the antiretroviral therapy is, but it prevents somebody from acquiring HIV if exposed to it. So there's lots of really good options.
What's the difference between a drug that reduces your chance of getting the virus mm-hmm. and a vaccine?
Well, the vaccine, I guess, would be a one-time thing that would then, you know, disallow a virus from coming into a cell. But then the drug that you take, it starts to decline in your blood over time. So you okay. have to take it daily.
Okay.
That's the okay. difference.
Great. So now let's bring this out of the individual or the couple and then think about how HIV sort of is spatialized on the landscape. As you know, geographers, we love to map things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we think about how HIV prevalence might look on a map, it's associated with how people move around. So can you talk a little bit about the intersection between HIV prevalence and mobility?
Sure. I can answer that question on a lot of different levels. If you just think about mapping HIV incidence or the number of new cases of HIV or HIV prevalence, the number of people who are currently living with HIV, you can see some significant patterns. And often those are related to the proportion of people of a certain age, of a certain sexual minority status, a certain race, ethnicity. So as I mentioned before, HIV is disproportionately affected by certain people, and those certain people live in different places. But what I specifically study is more like activity spaces and where people move during the course of a day. Well, currently, that's what I'm studying. And I find it really interesting to think about hotspots of HIV risk or places where transmission events might occur, as opposed to mapping where people who are living with HIV live. And the idea is because if we're trying to find unique, innovative ways to prevent HIV or provide treatment, we may want to have out of healthcare facility events, you know, or peer mediated delivery of medication, or mobile trucks that come by with HIV testing. And a lot of the research we've done recently with sexual minority men has bring up this idea that sometimes these places where people socialize or engage in sex are not necessarily where they live. So mapping where they live might not be that useful.
Oh, interesting. So it's just sort of like if you wanted to look at somebody's exposure to air pollution, you can't just look at where they live. You also need to look at where they work and the places that they operate throughout the day.
Exactly.
You know, you've mentioned a couple of times that there's a disproportionate number of Black and Latinx men that have HIV. Why is that?
If I knew the answer to that question, I'd probably get the Nobel Prize. It's really complicated and unclear. And also, there's a different question between why is there a current disparity and why did that become the case?
Right.
Right. So currently, we see it probably because there's homophily in sexual networks. And what does that mean? Well, sexual networks aren't random. My mentor, Martina Morris, used to say, okay, close your eyes, hold hands with two people. Like, that's your sexual network. No, you don't randomly choose who you have sex with. It's very structured in terms of similar people of similar age groups and race groups as well. I think like 90% or more white people have a white partner, Black people have Black partners. And so we see this homophily, or like mixing with like. And so already, if, say, I'm a Black woman and I'm looking for a Black male partner, the prevalence of HIV in the Black male population is already higher. Therefore, I'm already at higher risk simply by partner choice.
So, but just to be clear, the virus doesn't distinguish between people based on race. So,
no, okay. Yes, that's very important. Genetics really has no role in this story at all. And I would even go further to say behaviors, like choices of how to have sex, whether to use condoms, number of sexual partners, that also absolutely does not explain the racial disparity between Black and white, especially for HIV.
You know, I feel like we could bring 20 different health geographers together who study 20 different health outcomes, and most of them would give us the same story, that there are disparities in health based on race that are really beyond the physical, that aren't explained by sort of physical risk factors.
Yeah, genetics or even behaviors. And that's, I think, health geography in a nutshell. Behaviors can only explain a certain little bit of health disparities, and the rest of it, I'd say the vast majority of it, are social determinants of health, structural determinants of health, exposures of where people, you know, policies or structural characteristics. And it's the same thing for sexually transmitted infections.
I see a close parallel between health geography and public health generally, which is, I think, really come to the fore during COVID-19 as we think about sort of the public health response to managing COVID-19. And even with something that's transmitted through the air, there's a lot of conflict between individual behavior and choice and sort of the community response of public health and health geography. Do you see that in your own work, that sort of tension between individual behavior and sort of community level protection?
Yeah, that's a great question. Even in class today, this morning, we were talking about human ecology of disease and thinking about behaviors, but also community level characteristics. And so vaccines is one good thing. So somebody could choose to get a vaccine for COVID, for example, that would reduce their risk of acquiring disease or the risk of severity of disease. But above and beyond that, living in a community that has either a higher or a lower level or prevalence of people who are vaccinated also affects my health. So I think it's so important to kind of think about these community or population level variables above and beyond individual choice. So we can flip it around the other way and think about how individual choice also has these larger consequences to your community and the people who you live with.
When we think about a public health response to something like HIV, there are campaigns to increase people's access to healthcare, to increase education. Are there any sort of areas that you find that your research particularly informs the policy intervention?
So I have two answers to that. One is what my research focuses on, and the other is just what I think generally is important for HIV prevention and sexual health. I'll start with the research. So my research is really targeted towards optimizing prevention or intervention delivery. So where in space and time can you get the biggest bang for your buck? So my work looks for these hot spots, like I mentioned, hot spots of potential exposure and transmission places. But then I want to know how these places are connected to other places. So if you have 10 hot spots, which one should you target? Because that way, you can have almost like trickle-down prevention interventions, right? Kind of like because of these places are connected in a network through sexual partnerships or the geography of sex or people moving, you know, then if someone gets an intervention, they're less likely to transmit, then the effects of that prevention go beyond the hotspot. So that's what my work is targeting, optimizing out of healthcare facility interventions.
So when you say an intervention, what do you mean?
Oh, sure. Delivering pre-exposure prophylaxis or almost like a peer delivery. So, you know, COVID tests are super scarce right now. But if I wanted to go to a party, I could bring 10 COVID tests and give them to my friends. You can think of it the same thing with HIV. Theoretically, this isn't the case yet. But, you know, you could optimize, you could use these friendship networks or sexual networks to actually deliver prevention interventions. So that's just an example. The second part of HIV prevention research that I think is important, but my work doesn't touch upon directly, is twofold. Reducing stigma so that people feel comfortable accessing prevention and care, and inclusive sex ed in middle school or younger even.
Okay, I've got to ask.
Sure.
How do you collect your data? I mean, getting people to talk about whether or not they've had a vaccine can be, or to COVID, can be tricky, and it can require a friendship and some trust. But you're asking about the most personal parts of people's lives. How do you go about getting people to talk to you, and what kind of data do you use in your analysis?
That's a good question. Most of my work involves survey-based data. So that means I or my research partners go out and collect data. In the past, it used to be we would bring pencil and paper, we'd knock on a person's door, we'd, you know, tell them about how our research has been approved by a human subjects board, which is very important for human subjects research to get ethical approval. And then after that, so we ensure confidentiality, and then we ask them questions. We don't say, "Hi, I'm Susie. I'm a professor at UCSB. How many times did you have sex last year?" We don't
really?
Do that. No. But we start off with, you know, building rapport and asking simple questions. And then eventually we do actually ask those sensitive questions. Like the last time you had sex, who was it with? Where were you? What did you do? Did you use protection? You know, we do ask those questions. And there's always a risk of social desirability bias or people not telling us the truth or telling us what they think we want to hear. But we ask this to 500 people.
Right.
And so on average, we have to assume that we get good data.
You must have had a few doors slammed if you were going door to door.
Honestly, our acceptance rate of people who actually were there was above 95%.
Oh, wow.
People like to talk about themselves, right. I find.
What are the big questions, from your perspective, that need to be addressed to improve management of HIV or to reduce the potential for transmission? What research is really needed right now?
Well, so of course there's the biomedical research, you know, they're still looking for a cure, still looking for a vaccine. That's very important. but I think a lot more research and money needs to be invested in these social and behavioral research agendas to address these bigger elephants in the room, like stigma and racism and education, health ed, sex ed, you know, and for younger people, and not just heterosexual sex ed, you know. Accepting that there are a lot of different types of people, and knowing what healthy sex looks like for everyone is important. So yeah, social and behavioral research to address these upstream, larger structural and social drivers of health.
There's two things that pop out from what you've just said. The first is that I'm surprised we don't have a vaccine for HIV. So we came up with a vaccine for COVID. Well, not we, because I don't create vaccines. Mm-hmm. However, as you know, society, we came up with a vaccine for COVID in about a year. And so what's the difference? Is it that HIV is more difficult?
Or
more difficult virus?
Difficult virus. Yeah, I'm not a virologist, but the main reason is because HIV is constantly mutating and evading of treatments. So it changes a lot more quickly compared to, say, COVID.
Okay. So it's not just because we haven't invested sufficient effort. Okay.
That's right.
The second thing that you said in that last answer that stuck with me is the idea of stigma and how... So it was interesting. Yesterday in my son's middle school, they COVID tested every single student, and a number of kids had it. And he commented how he was relieved he didn't have it because he felt really sorry for the kids who were probably pretty embarrassed to have COVID. And again, like compared to something like HIV, which transmits in a much more personal way, COVID seems like everyone's got it. Why are you worried about this? So it just makes me reflect on how the stigma of both being sort of non-heterosexual person can be really hard, and also how the stigma of HIV could be really a barrier to getting the support you need, both not to get it, but also to live with it.
Yeah, no, it really is an important facet of HIV research. And it's important to think about it in different geographic areas as well, like the Deep South versus California, different cultures, you know, like Hispanic culture, and talking about sexuality in general, let alone non-straight sexuality. Yeah, these things are hard, and the answers aren't clear necessarily how to improve upon this. One could be more anonymous type prevention. So we now have HIV self-tests, so people can just go to CVS and buy a test, kind of like a COVID test.
Right.
As opposed to walking into, say, an HIV clinic, which they may not want to do if Bob from down the street would see.
You mentioned that some of your work is international. So whereabouts are you working outside the U.S.?
Well, so my very first research project was in Ghana. And I got a grant from the National Institutes of Health to look at geographic mobility and sexual networks in Ghana to try to understand how HIV is spread through networks and how different places were tied through mobility. That was in Accra, where we interviewed 500 people and asked about the last three sexual partners, and not only where they went to on traveling, but where their sexual partners lived and where actual sex took place. So that was... that was my first study in Ghana. And I still collaborate with researchers mostly in Kenya and Ghana.
So when in Kenya and Ghana, when you look at the mobility of networks and you kind of think about how they vary compared to the mobility of U.S. networks, is there differences? Are people traveling more for sex, or are the networks spread out more?
So I don't have the data to answer that question, to compare the actual networks, but it's more about looking at patterns of mobility by gender. Say, do women travel more than men? What are the reasons for travel, and whether or not those are associated with risky behavior? So there's a big literature out about geographic mobility and sexual risk behavior, And the question is whether people who are mobile are more likely to engage in sex or have more partners or more extramarital partners, for example.
What is mobile? How do you define that?
Well, it depends. In one of my studies, it was any time that a person slept away from home.
Okay.
But other people define it by geographic boundaries, so leaving an administrative district or moving to the next state or permanent moves as opposed to just a trip or travel. So that's what makes our research complicated.
Great.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that we don't talk about HIV as much as we used to. You know, people live with it. It's not as visible. Do you think this leads to people thinking HIV isn't in their communities, that it's something that happens to others? And if so, what message do you think it's important for people to hear?
Well, I'd say that sexuality is a human thing. I mean, we're all born. We are all, sex is something that everybody does or could do. And sexually transmitted infections is just another virus or bacteria that affects people. And it's not something to be ashamed of. And it isn't always just the others. I mean, for example, syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, these are all very prevalent sexually transmitted diseases. And HIV is just another sexually transmitted disease. So I'd say for people who are interested in engaging in these issues, it's really important to think about what healthy sexuality means, how to teach sex ed in schools early so it's not a stigmatized thing, and just to make it part of our lives and not hidden, and to not other people or to not shame people.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being here today on Earth Plus Humans. It's been fascinating to talk with you.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Thanks for joining us on Earth Plus Humans. Now I'm off to register for Dr. Castle's class on sex, drugs, and geography.